You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the financial meltdown that took place in September and October 2008, the American financial industry underwent some major upheavals. Bear Stearns was bought in a shotgun marriage. Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy. Insurance giant AIG received a government loan to keep it afloat. And Bank of America had its own shotgun marriage with Wall Street icon Merrill Lynch. The sale quickly became controversial, from questions of why Merrill Lynch bankers were getting their bonuses to whether Bank of America had paid too much for the faltering financial institution. Joining me now to untangle what led up to the sale, how the terms were negotiated, the lawsuits, and what's happened since is Financial Times correspondent Greg Farrell. His book, Crash of the Titans, Greed, Hubris, The Fall of Merrill Lynch, and the Near Collapse of Bank of America, is published by Crown Business. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you.
Had Bank of America shown interest in buying Merrill Lynch before September 2008?
Yes. On and off for more than a decade, but most notably exactly a year earlier, in September of 2007. And the reason they were interested then is that the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Stan O'Neill, who had just begun to realize the magnitude of the problems on Merrill's balance sheet before anyone outside the firm was aware of it, reached out to a lawyer friend, Ed Herlihy, who was involved in all of B of A's deals, and said, you know, maybe now's the right time to have that conversation we've been talking about. And quickly, a meeting was put together between Stan O'Neill of Merrill Lynch and Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America.
And what was the share price that they discussed?
The $90 minimum per share. And once O'Neill got to the meeting, he said, I've been thinking about this, and given Merrill's long history, I think close to $100 a share would be better. And Lewis took it in stride. So yes, that was in September of 07, that was no firm offer was made, but the fact that they were that specific meant that they could have Lewis would have moved forward in that level.
Was anybody aware of just how heavily invested in subprime mortgages Merrill Lynch was at that time?
At that time.
I mean, other than Stanley O'Neill, who obviously was moved to make this offer because he was kind of panicking, I assume.
Yes. There was a small group of executives within Merrill Lynch, starting at the fixed income department and leading up to Stan's right-hand man, who were aware of this and were very alarmed. And even then, a year before Merrill had to be sold, were concerned that this was, a hole in the side of the ship that could not be repaired.
So $90 and $100 is kind of like just...
It was spectacular, yes, yeah, well, exactly. But
he couldn't have imagined it would actually go through for something like that.
Well, that's... In reporting this, one thing I've tried to do is I've spoke to a lot of people involved in this back in 07 and in 08, and with the passage of time, people start remembering things in the most favorable light possible as to what they were doing. And but I have to remind myself that was a very fast-moving activity. One day there's a discovery of a big exposure. The next day there's no way to get rid of it. The next day Stan gets in trouble with his board. The next day after that he's fired. There was no sort of – it's easy in retrospect to sort of fill this in how A led to B, but this is where things got very tumultuous very quickly.
Was Stanley O'Neill a popular CEO?
No. He was feared. He was respected. He was a radical change from the CEOs that Merrill Lynch had throughout its nearly century history, insofar as not only did he not come from the stockbroker background, but he didn't really he was not invested in the culture of Merrill Lynch. In fact, he tried to eradicate, all the sort of nepotism and backslapping salesmanship that had been allowed to proliferate there.
But he also seemed to be rather confident in his own judgment and fired anyone who he felt threatened him intellectually. That's not necessarily a morale-building environment.
Yes, exactly. So gone was the Mother Merrill, which took care of people, even people who shouldn't have been kept on. And in was a new culture that was more meritocracy, but also all directed in the direction Stan wanted to go. And yes, challenges to Stan were not brooked. Top executive, including the current chief executive of Morgan Stanley, was a senior executive. James Gorman was a top lieutenant to O'Neill, and at a certain point, O'Neill just didn't want to hear his either complaints or differing views. And before you knew it, Gorman was promoted to a job with no staff, a small office, and he knew that his days were numbered.
At a Merrill Lynch Board of Directors meeting in April 2007, Osman Samersi, the head of the firm's fixed income commodities and currencies business, told them that only 6% of the department's revenues came from subprime mortgages, about $550 million. That wasn't true. Why was he telling them that?
That's correct. Now, I'm given to understand that, first of all, that there was a general presentation about Merrill's revenues coming from the mortgage business. And actually, let me correct that. I don't have any issue with the amount of revenue coming from that claim. If you look at a specific legal definition, a lot of the revenue was coming from CDOs, which were repackaged, securities that were created out of, minted from, forged from subprime mortgages. So in a technical aspect, that statement was defensible. However, one board member specifically asked him at that meeting, or asked one of his subordinates, is that all the subprime exposure we have? And Samersi responded to that by saying, yes, that's all. Even though there was a much bigger CDO exposure, more than $30 billion.
So now, he was being technical in
his
answer.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if depending on your political persuasion, you might say Clintonian in his response. But
it depends on what is.
Exactly, and depends on what you mean by subprime.
What distinguished Merrill Lynch from the other Wall Street firms? Weren't they reaching out to the average American investor in a way that others didn't?
What distinguished Merrill Lynch, and what I think makes this a particularly sad story, is that Merrill did business on Wall Street, brought Wall Street to Main Street, but was not of Wall Street. It was not a pure investment bank. It was just the opposite. In the 1940s, Charlie Merrill basically cobbled together a series of networks of salesmen, stockbrokers, who would help to bring the average American back into the stock market. Americans back then were still fearful and still smarting from the great collapse of 1929 and the depression that followed. So in order to, Charlie Merrill, instead of going after the big fish, the plutocrats of his era, wanted to build a network of small mom and pop investors. And he did that first. He did that fastest. And as a result, at the end of the 20th century, Merrill was considered rock solid. Merrill Lynch was the type of place that never should have gone down in a financial panic because it had less exposure, because of this business, to the vagaries of the stock market.
I seem to remember a Merrill desk at a Sears store. Is that?
Yes, no, absolutely. There was a number of, I would say, marketing gimmicks or promotions. They used to have a Merrill desk in Grand Central, in the early 40s or the 50s. Merrill Lynch has it's a great history of marketing and reaching out to consumers. It was the first firm of its kind to advertise on TV. That's where the whole notion of the thundering herd and bullish on America comes from.
Now, you mentioned that Osman Samersi was playing fast and loose with the language when he talked about what was happening there, didn't mention collateralized debt obligations, which Merrill was deeply involved in. Was he a controversial choice when he was hired?
He was. And Stan O'Neill liked him a lot because he was a top producer. He was a terrific salesman. He had been a salesman in London and in Tokyo and had been selling a lot of fixed income products and doing a terrific job. And he, at a lot of investment banks, he who produces the most revenue for the firm moves up the fastest. When he was put in this job as head of fixed income, Stan O'Neill, forced this choice on Dow Kim, who was the head of sales and trading. When he was put in place, he wasn't the most experienced in terms of managing a fixed income department. And he admitted in his first opening speech when he arrived in New York, he didn't understand fixed income in the U.S. that much, but he was looking forward to learning it. One of the problems, however, was everybody knew that this guy was backed by Stan O'Neill. Stan had even presented him to the board or described him to the board as potential CEO material. So he got very little of the pushback that other selections would have gotten. So a combination of someone who wasn't steeped in the risk component of the business, the fact that he was considered untouchable because he was Stan's guy, I think led to less pushback on him, ended up, and probably just the prevailing view that all the CDOs that ended up on Merrill's balance sheet were, most of them were technically AAA. So, that's a defensible people in the know knew that AAA no longer meant AAA. Mm-hmm. But to the average person, it was a defensible position that these are AAA securities we've got on our balance sheet. So
My guest is Greg Farrell, a correspondent for the Financial Times. He's written a book called Crash of the Titans, actually a story that he covered, subtitled Greed, Hubris, the Fall of Merrill Lynch, and the Near Collapse of Bank of America, which is published by Crown Business. There's another character in the story, Lawrence Tosi, who worked at Merrill Lynch's sales and trading department, and he became alarmed at Merrill's positions in subprime mortgages.
Yes.
So does he wind up being the truth teller in this story?
It's yes. He is a senior executive, and I told the story or put him at the center of this because it showed the lack of transparency at senior levels at Merrill Lynch. At a board meeting in July of 2007, now the subprime mortgage market has taken a serious turn south, and two hedge funds backed by Bear Stearns have blown up or in the process of blowing up. So now, as opposed to April of 2007, there's general concern at the board level. And
but there's a lot of secrecy. How does Tosi even find out?
Well, at the presentation,
there's a problem.
At the presentation to the board, Osmond Cimmersi and his deputy Dale Latanzio make a presentation in which they describe what's going on and how Merrill's fairly well protected. And in passing, there's a chart that shows that Merrill's balance sheet, you know, has north of $30 billion of CDO related products on his balance sheet. And that's when Tosi and a few others in the room got alarmed. They saw this. They did not know that there was that much on Merrill Lynch's balance sheet. Merrill Lynch had been in the moving business, not the storage business. And to find now that the firm had amassed basically the largest single position CDOs at the worst possible time, frankly, freaked Tosi out. So he and others, but he, you know, was determined to get to the bottom of this. How did this happen? And so he had to negotiate with Cimmersi, find out, you know, as well as he could, how these positions came about. And Cimmersi's position had been, this was all there when I got here. I've just been trying to, you know, limit the damage that my predecessor did. But it took 2 months, but Cimmersi spoke to enough people who worked there that he concluded and convinced top management that it was Cimmersi and his team that had put together the position.
And they were fired, Cimmersi and
yes,
his top
they were
deputy.
Fired in early October, just 2 days before Merrill pre-announced a big loss. Merrill Lynch was the first, to its credit, was the first Wall Street firm to warn investors that there were big problems on its balance sheet.
And then O'Neill left as CEO. John Thain succeeded him in December 2007. This is a man who has a great CV. He'd been CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. He'd worked for Goldman Sachs, becoming co-president. But I would think that would have caused a little tension as well.
Yeah, well, there are two things.
Because we're talking culture shock here, aren't we?
Definitely culture shock. But at the same time, Merrill Lynch had been so rocked by the events of October, November 07 that Thain was very much welcomed with open arms, seen as a savior, and the guy who had miraculously turned around the New York Stock Exchange, saved that from, you know, the dangerous place to which it had gotten, people were welcoming on board. Particularly because he's a very bright guy, was one of the early players in the mortgage market in the 1980s. And again, the Goldman background, better than a Harvard degree, is sort of the imprimatur of someone who really knows his stuff on Wall Street. So,
well, how aware was Thain of the problems at Merrill Lynch or all throughout Wall Street at that point?
I think that the 4 years he did between Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch when he was at the New York Stock Exchange, where he was out of the day-to-day operations of the business, I think that's a long time period in Wall Street and a long time period in the buildup of this market. So I'm not prepared to say that he didn't understand it, but he seemed to have a benign view of the whole market. And he had, based on his 25 years experience on Wall Street, this generally optimistic point of view that, well, we're in a downturn now, but things are about to come back in 2008. And like, you know, everything we have in the balance sheet, having taken a few losses, will start rising in value and the firm will be okay.
And nobody understood that CDOs in themselves were a major problem that could never rebound?
No, I think they were an asset class, and there's still a lot of hope and optimism by some quarters of Wall Street that they would bounce back like every other asset class always bounces back.
Greg Farrell's book, Crash of the Titans, Greed, Hubris, the Fall of Merrill Lynch, and the Near Collapse of Bank of America, is published by Crown Business. We will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Greg Farrell, who is a correspondent for the Financial Times. He's written a book called Crash of the Titans, Greed, Hubris, The Fall of Merrill Lynch, and The Near Collapse of Bank of America, which is published by Crown Business. After the sale of Merrill Lynch, Thain ran into some pretty high-profile public relations problems, the expensive remodeling of his office, and later the bonuses that had been written into the broker's contracts. Was that unusual for him, or did Thain always have trouble with communication skills?
Thain was not a great communicator naturally. He had worked on this when he was at the New York Stock Exchange, and he developed a very good relationship with the public relations woman whom he brought in to the New York Stock Exchange, Margaret Tutwiler, who had worked in the various Republican administrations in Washington. And she took a novel approach to positioning Thain, treating him like she used to treat her boss, Secretary of State James Baker, as, press conference, let him speak. And Thain was smart enough, bright enough, knowledgeable enough that he could handle his own. He impressed people, and he comported himself very well. And this enhanced his image, and then the turnaround at the New York Stock Exchange, it gave him the credibility that he could, almost with the snap of a finger, raise $13 billion in new capital for Merrill Lynch, money that Stan O'Neill at that point could not have gotten.
So why did he make these mistakes? I mean, at a point of a serious economic crisis, remodeling his office, and then the bonuses, that's a story you broke.
Yes. So two things. One, the office redecoration occurred early in his tenure, in his first month.
But other people had gotten into similar problems, buying expensive garbage cans and things like that.
Yeah.
I would have thought at that point people would have been going to Target to buy anything for their offices.
That is the surprise here, is that, sitting on an orange crate would have, given them out the message that we're in a turnaround situation and we're going to fix this business first. But again, I think his main fault, or what I found, is that he was overly optimistic. He, as of December 2007, thought the worst was over, and that the asset prices, having raised a certain amount of capital, the asset prices would come back up. So he was building for the future. He ended up hiring a couple of very senior Goldman Sachs executives at great cost, $30 million and $40 million guaranteed each, to come in during 2008. These, again, were proof of his long-term focus, that he viewed the worst as over, and it was time to build for the next 5 years. Reconstruction of the office, spending $1 million plus to redo the office, is an indication of the same mindset. Like, the problems are over, now let's build, for the future. But it also showed a real tin ear to, the public sensibility and what was really happening there.
What about the bonuses? The story you broke. Now, they claim, well, they had no choice. That was built into the contract.
So if we get to September of 2008 now, and Thain did not want to sell Merrill Lynch, but Bank of America made such a good offer that he essentially couldn't refuse. Part of any deal or contract like that, Bank of America is not buying a building. They're not buying a software infrastructure. They're buying the services of tens of thousands of employees, 60,000 employees.
And a great name.
And a great brand name, absolutely. And it's important not to keep all 60,000 employees, but to at least keep 10 or 20 or 30,000 of the most important ones. And Wall Street is very much a bonus culture. And even though the folks in Charlotte at Bank of America headquarters loathed the Wall Street bonus culture and the multi-million-dollar pay packages, they knew that in order to keep this crown jewel intact, they would have to, let Merrill Lynch pay its, top people, its key people, a certain amount much higher than they were used to paying at their own bank to keep them on board. So it was negotiated in the September original agreement to merge, to acquire Merrill Lynch, that Merrill could pay almost as much as they had paid out in 2007 in terms of bonuses. Now, where Bank of America got into problems with this was that they never disclosed that in their prospectus to their own shareholders. In fact, they made an explicit statement before their shareholders voted on December 5th, 2008. They made explicit statements to the effect that we'll allow no, out of control, over the top pay packages without express approval, not disclosing that, in fact, they'd already given pre-approval for Merrill to pay $3.6 to $4 billion in bonuses out on their own.
Wasn't Merrill also courting Morgan Stanley to buy them?
Over that
weekend.
Was
that serious?
It was serious to John Thain. I think he saw this as a selling to Bank of America is pushing, it's the nuclear option. It's pushing the button. Merrill Lynch will exist no more. A merger with Morgan Stanley keeps it alive and keeps gives Thain the potential to emerge as the CEO at Morgan Stanley, and so is a way for Thain to continue to save the ship and keep running the ship himself. There was also talk of getting Goldman Sachs, Thain's old friends at Goldman Sachs, to buy up to 10% in the firm to get it through the few weeks. I think everybody there realized that within a few weeks or a few months, the worst would be over, and the upside on the other end was fantastic. But it was some of the legacy Merrill Lynch people there who were advising Thain who insisted, no, we're not going to get through this. If Lehman's going down this weekend, mid-September 2008. If we don't do this deal, we're not going to make it till Tuesday.
Well, they actually got a pretty good deal, according to everybody, but it was one-third of what originally had been discussed. Instead of $100 or $90 a share, it was $29 a share that Bank of America paid, and people feel that was an artificially high price.
Yes.
And was Bank of America aware that they were paying more than they probably could have gotten away with?
Well, Bank of America became the colossus that it did. It used to be Nations Bank, North Carolina Nations Bank, then Nations Bank, and it grew and became the biggest bank in the country through acquisitions. And when they acquired, they wanted to acquire oceanfront property, not the bargain basement cheaper thing that needed to be fixed up. They wanted the best franchises, and they were willing to pay up for that. Greg Fleming, who was Thain's president, knew this and did a lot of deals with the other Charlotte bank, Wachovia, and he understood that Bank of America was willing to pay top dollar. He also had learned by this weekend, and he was the lead negotiator, that a year earlier, Ken Lewis had been willing to pay 90 to 100 bucks a share. So he was shooting for 30 bucks a share if he could get it. Now, the other thing, in retrospect, what helped Fleming's case a lot was Ken Lewis and everybody else in Charlotte knew that the last thing John Thain wanted to do was sell Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. So they knew they would have to come in with a high offer. And one other little fact that was unknown until it came out afterwards was that John Thain had no change of control clause. In other words, there was no big payday for Thain if the bank was sold. Such was his confidence a year earlier that he didn't see the need to tie himself to his credit. And that benefited Merrill Lynch shareholders. The fact that John Thain did not have a change of control meant that Bank of America would have to pay top dollar. So Merrill shareholders benefited because the folks in Charlotte knew that they would have to come in with an offer so high that it could not be refused.
Well, why were they so hot to buy Merrill Lynch? What could Merrill give Ken Lewis and Bank of America that Bank of America didn't already have?
Well, Bank of America had its own smaller investment bank and trading operation in New York, and Merrill's was much larger, and particularly in stocks, was a much better operation, although B of A's in debt was better. More
importantly, they had also thought about buying Lehman Brothers at one point.
Yes and no. They had kicked the tires there largely because they had been pushed to by Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary. There was never, I think, any real interest in that. It was part of some horse trading going on between Lewis and Paulson. No, rather, what made Merrill Lynch attractive to Bank of America in the 1990s and made it attractive to them a couple of years ago and makes it attractive to them today is this vast army, 15,000 stockbrokers, financial advisors across the U.S. who have these high net worth clients, which is a reliable stream of revenues. Now, Bank of America is the largest retail bank in the country, so they have, you know, a lot of mass affluent clients, and they saw the ability to cross-sell to get, you know, their own customers, you know, to do business with Merrill Lynch brokers and vice versa.
My guest is Greg Farrell, whose Crash of the Titans, Greed, Humorous, The Fall of Merrill Lynch and the Near Collapse of Bank of America is published by Crown Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What role did the Federal Reserve and the Treasury play in moving the sale toward completion? It was reported that they threatened Ken Lewis, cajoled him by offering him further TARP funds, but never put anything in writing.
Correct. And this has been a subject that was well explored in 2009. Through congressional hearings and elsewhere. And it's part of the mismanagement, I think, at Bank of America that Lewis and company made this offer on the spur of the moment in mid-September. And over the next 3 months, as the market conditions got significantly worse, didn't amend the offer or inform their shareholders of losses that Merrill Lynch was ringing up. Only at the last hour, as it were, in mid-December of 2008, did Lewis, seemingly in a panic, call Paulson and say, you know, this deal doesn't make sense. We're going to invoke our material adverse change clause. And that's where Paulson and then Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve got involved and said, no, you've got to do this deal or else the whole market will go down.
Well, Lehman Brothers had already...
Lehman Brothers had gone, and that had caused significant damage. AIG had to have been bailed out, and this would have just been catastrophic for the market. So they said, we'll give you $20 billion. We'll give you a package that we gave to Citigroup, and if you don't take it, if you continue to try to break this up, we'll use that as grounds to get rid of you and your board.
Now, did this all happen during the final months of the Bush administration? Did anything change after the White House changed hands?
Not significantly. My understanding is that Tim Geithner, who was president of the New York Fed, the most important of the Federal Reserve banks outside of Washington, had been tapped at this point by December of 2008 to be Treasury Secretary in the Obama administration, and that Paulson and Bernanke had kept him apprised. So there was no significant disagreement. There was a, you know, I think Geithner agreed that the Bank of America Merrill Lynch deal, you know, that Paulson and Bernanke were on the right track, that they should continue to make this happen. There was a deadline, however. Paulson needed to get this done by January 20th when the new administration was going to be in place. So you had this bizarre scene in mid-January when, you know, Bank of America's already closed the deal, but the public, the wider world does not know that they needed an extra $20 billion. And when that seeped out, and that had to come out. Paulson didn't want to put anything in writing about their commitment to B of A, but when they dispersed an additional $20 billion in TARP funds, that it had to come out. That caused real panic, and the share price of Bank of America, which had been in the 50s a year earlier, sank down into single digits.
Hey, there are some details in here that are rather embarrassing. There was urgency surrounding things that weekend, and yet you report that when Bank of America executives were supposed to be performing due diligence on buying Merrill, they were watching a Carolina Panthers football game. Did they feel that they just needed a break?
No, I think this was the attitude, that they had their underlings, their minions, going over Merrill Lynch's books, and they didn't have to worry too much about this. It also is a warning sign of the culture clash that is to come, where, you know, the good old boys in Charlotte, you know, who like watching their football, they go down to the bar at the bottom of the building at 5 p.m. a couple of nights a week to knock back a whiskey. This is sort of the traditions down there, and I inserted that scene not so much because there was an egregious, you know, oversight in that moment as much as it showed the attitudes. The folks at Bank of America were going to do this deal, and short of anything catastrophic, they really, it was by Sunday, they had decided they were going to go through with it.
In October, after the merger was announced but hadn't been approved, Merrill's fortunes continued to decline. Why didn't Bank of America try to renegotiate the terms of the sale? Couldn't Ken Lewis have gotten the firm for much less than the $29 that they had in the initial deal?
Yes. This shows the...
And Merrill Lynch expected that.
Yes, exactly. Merrill Lynch's own executives were working out scenarios, preparing their top people, saying, okay, the guys in Merrill Lynch Treasury, when the B of A calls and tries to renegotiate this deal because we just lost an additional $7 billion this month. When they try to renegotiate, which is the inevitable call, here's what you say to try to keep them on board at the $29 per share price. The call never came. Same in November when a few more billion in losses were added. It's a strange sort of radio silence and, again, an indication of the lack of communication. And only when it was too late, when shareholders had approved it, did B of A's top people, Ken Lewis et al., decide, I got to get out of this. It's just the management was, the oversight was lacking here.
And Ken Lewis didn't fully disclose what he knew about Merrill Lynch's balance sheet when shareholders voted on the sale because he wanted the sale approved. Didn't Bank of America's general counsel, Tim Mayopoulos, raise his concerns about the disclosure that Bank of America was making about the sale?
He raised concerns about it, and there's a series of notes which I put in the book going back and forth between Mayopoulos, who was then general counsel, and the internal attorneys at Wachtell Lipton as to what kind of disclosure they might make to shareholders. But when they found out that Merrill Lynch wasn't planning to make any specific unusual disclosures to their own people, their own shareholders before December 5th, they decided it wasn't that important. Now, what is significant is that in the days leading up to the shareholder vote, two executives above Mayopoulos, Joe Price, the CFO, and Greg Curl, the deal guy, both approached him and asked Mayopoulos, can we invoke the material adverse change clause to get out of this? And he said, probably not. That's given the way it's been negotiated, we can't do that. So that showed a mindset, an interest in that subject. Now,
Well, now we have Andrew Cuomo trying to bring up charges against Ken Lewis and Joe Price for trying to get Mayopoulos fired.
Yes. Basically, Cuomo's contention, and he filed this last February, late January, early February, a version of a fraud charge against Lewis and Joe Price for A, sacking Mayopoulos because he was, not fully supportive of their, basically because Mayopoulos thought there should be disclosure to shareholders and they didn't, and B, turning around after firing him and approaching, the federal government and essentially fooling him into thinking we need $20 billion to get through this, even though they had, told their shareholders otherwise. I'm not sure how strong that case is. The evidence that I found, and I put it in the book, is that one of the main reasons Mayopoulos was canned was because Bank of America needed to cut costs. Mayopoulos and his team in legal had been very vocal about being underpaid. And at a certain point, the head of HR at Bank of America got sick of hearing about this pay issue and decided to lop him off and put in another guy, a guy named Brian Moynihan, as general counsel.
And Ken Lewis resigned as the CEO of Bank of America. At September 2009, Brian Moynihan took the bank over. Has it been stabilized?
Yeah, I think it has. First of all, we now know, given the events of 2 years ago, that Bank of America is too big to fail. Secondly, Moynihan is a lot more involved in hands-on management, and there's a different style or culture that's brought to it. They still have problems, and not just from Merrill Lynch, actually more now from Countrywide. What got lost in the wash with Merrill Lynch is the purchase of Countrywide, brought in and tens of billions of dollars in lousy subprime mortgages onto the balance sheet. What Bank of America did, what Ken Lewis did leading up to Merrill Lynch was take one of the strongest banks in the country and expose it far more to the financial crisis than it should have been.
Bonus season is almost here, and Bloomberg News reported a few days ago that Wall Street will see its second best year in history in trading and investment banking. Why has Wall Street been able to bounce back so quickly? Is that because of the TARP funds that were provided in 2008 and 2009?
Indirectly, yes. The TARP funds ultimately helped stabilize the bank system. And after the horrendous fourth quarter of 2008, the knowledge that the federal government was going to back up Wall Street essentially, led to people trading again in 2009. So 2009 was a good year, and now there's fewer players and fewer competitors in the business, Bear Stearns and Lehman being gone and Merrill being absorbed by Bank of America. So you have fewer players divvying up the pie and being able to make more money at it.
Just one more thing. We just had the president sign the biggest overhaul of financial regulation since the Great Depression. Will they prevent this sort of thing that we've been talking about in the future?
I think to some extent they will. This, to me, the Dodd-Frank bill is analogous to for the banking system to the Sarbanes-Oxley. And Sarbanes-Oxley, which still gets criticized in many quarters of the business world, I think has helped reduce the incidence of accounting frauds that have taken place. It will never eliminate it because you can never eliminate bad actors. I think something similar will come down. It's going to take a year or several years for all the individual rules that are part of Dodd-Frank to be, made into law.
But why is Wall Street doing so well when the rest of the economy is still struggling?
Well, because consider it like the heart, the organ that pumps the blood out to the extremities. And it's most important, even though people complain about Wall Street being saved, you can't let the heart die or else the whole patient dies. So there's still a tremendous, need for the country, even more than General Motors or Chrysler, to keep the heart beating, to keep the, the blood flowing throughout the system. And Wall Street is right at that sweet spot.
Greg Farrell is a correspondent for the Financial Times. He's written a book about a story he's covered for that publication, Crash of the Titans, Greed, Hubris, the Fall of Merrill Lynch, and the Near Collapse of Bank of America. It's published by Crown Business. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.